What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocoa peats, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you. Especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in this smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was...
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan...
Mawlavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Qur'an.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, ulama and scholars all across the world of Islam during the history of Islam. For today's discussion, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the life of an alim, a faqih, and the muhaddis of the 13th century Hijra, Sayyid Abdullah Shubar, mainly known as Al-Majlisi As-Sani. Sheikh Rouhani, first give us some details about the early life and biography of Sayyid Abdullah Shubar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Sayyid Abdullah ibn Sayyid Muhammad Rida Shubar Husayni Najafi Kazimi. This is the full name of this great scholar who lived in the 13th century of Qamari calendar. He was among the great Shiite scholars in that century, and he is among the trustworthy kind of narrators and transmitters of hadith of the Imamiyya. And of course, he wrote many tafasir interpretation on the ayat of the Holy Quran as well, and he was born in Najaf al-Ashraf. Then he moved to Qadhimiyya and lived there for the rest of his life. And of course, he is known as Majlisi Athani because of his great works and books that he compiled in the history of the Shayu.
Yes.
Of course, he is Najafi, but he was buried, I think, in Qadhimiyya. And that's why he is, of course, among the well-known Shiite scholars and narrators and Mufassir of the Holy Quran.
That's all right. Okay. Sheikh Fadai Sayyid Abdullah Shobar is known as a prolific writer, a person who writes a lot. That's why the Majlis Yassani, the title is given to him, a person who has so many compilations and authored many books. Just give us some details about the scholarly life, or it's better to say academic life, of Sayyid Abdullah Shobar. Then we'll get to more details of his life. For instance, his ideas regarding Usuli and Akhbari dialects.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Abdullah Shobar was born in Najaf, but he went to Qazimain and had his scholarly life in that city, I mean Qazimain. And yes, as you mentioned, he had a lot of works, scholarly works, and it is recorded that he had more than 70 books.
Yes.
And articles. And one of the reasons that he could have this success was the speed of his writing. Mm-hmm. He was known and famous for the speed of writing and, of course, for his great memory.
Yes.
He has mentioned that he had a very good memory. And sometimes he could write an article in one night.
Mm-hmm.
And once he was asked about this potential, and he answered that, "I got this from Imam Kazim alayhi salam."
Okay.
It means by Tawassul.
And just by the grace of Imam Kazim.
It was a special blessing from Imam Kazim that he could write very fast, and he had very great memory, and mm-hmm. he could write a lot of books. But it doesn't mean that just this alim, this scholar, had a lot of works. As you mentioned, he was known as Majlisi al-Sani.
Yes.
It means that he was like Allama Majlisi.
Yes.
Because of his various works. A lot of scholars, Shia scholars, had various books. And this was a process in Hosa,
mm-hmm.
that after several years,
yes.
that you are just students, you have to be a teacher, you have to be an author.
Yes.
And
it was like something like a thesis or dissertation at the
yes.
university in today's world, isn't
yes.
it?
But you know, okay. nowadays in Hosa and university, they only if you are forced to write, mm-hmm. for example, because
yes.
of doctoral thesis, I
yes.
don't know, MA thesis, they write. But if they are not forced for the certificates, they do not attend to writing.
Yes.
But in our traditional Hosa, it was very ordinal
mm-hmm.
that an Islamic scholar should write.
Yes.
So he had more than 70 books.
Yes.
And as you know, he was not so old. He
yes.
died at the age of 54.
58, maybe 54.
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
And if you just think about his youth,
yes.
I know, for example, imagine if you stored their book, his books, in the age of 20.
Yes.
He didn't have a lot of time to write such a books. For example, in the field of interpretation,
yes.
Tafsir al-Quran,
yes.
he had three books,
mm-hmm.
Tafsir al-Kabir, Tafsir al-Wasit, and Tafsir al-Wajiz.
Yes.
And the second one, Tafsir al-Wasit, Al-Johar al-Samin,
yes.
is very famous in the Hosa. Because the first one, the Kabir, was not published
uh-huh.
for all people.
So it was authored, but it's not
authored,
published.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a pattern for
yes.
Hosa University, to use scholarly life,
mm-hmm.
write a lot. So the future scholars, the future students, they can use from our job.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, he passed in a life that, 13th century Hijra, especially in the cities of Najaf, three important scholarly streams, it's better to say, were active, akhbari, usuli, and falsafi or philosophical, usuli and akhbari. And Sayyid Abdullah Shobar was among the Imamiya scholars who authored some works on criticizing some of the viewpoints of akhbaris. First of all, give us this differentiation, define for us what is exactly akhbari, usuli, and falsafi look and perspectives regarding Islamic studies.
Yes, of course. As you know, akhbari, the term akhbari is rooted in the word khabar,
yes,
which means narration and ahadith. So that is why these akhbari people or akhbari scholar are those scholars who just believe that we should refer in any details of our life to only to the narrations and ahadiths narrated from the Holy Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. And we shouldn't perform ijtihad, which is a specific kind of speciality that,
yes,
that the scholars have, the usuli, let's say ulama, perform it to drive actually the ahkam and the, let's say, religious duties of the followers of Islam from the sources, from the main Islamic sources. So that's why, when it comes to usuli scholars are of the view that no, only akhbar is not enough. Then a scholar should be a mujtahid, a professional, an expert, let's say, in different fields of his studies, and particularly in logic, in ilm al-usul, in, to some extent, in falsafa even.
Yes.
In different kind of fields of study, he must be specialized and, let's say, scholarly figure and history, for example. So then he will be able to understand, for example, that specific riwayah, that specific hukm of Islam. Is it adaptable, for example, for nowadays life or not? How should we perform it? How should we follow it? If we just directly refer to the riwayat and ahadith, because some of these riwayats are for a specific kind of condition,
yes,
situation, we cannot apply it for always, for example, to tell the Muslims that you have to fulfill all of them, these things, let's say, in your lives. So that's why these akhbaris just rely on the akhbar, but usulis relies on ijtihad,
yes,
which is which means that they refer to Quran, ayat of the Holy Quran, to the akhbar, ahadith,
yes,
as well as aql. They refer to aql and they refer to ijma, the other, let's say, consensus among the scholars, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things should be applied in order to get the true hukm of Islam.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the main difference between akhbari and usuli. They had actually conflict for many centuries, particularly in these centuries that Sayyid Shubbar lived.
That's right.
That was also the century.
And Sayyid Shubbar was a criticizer of the akhbari, yes, perspective and outlook on that time. That's all right. But Sheikh Fadai, there's still a third perspective, and that is philosophical one. I mean, the akhbari one and the usuli ones were explained by Sheikh Rouhani, and this philosophical one. Can we say that, for example, the philosophical and the akhbari are two radical extremes of same pole, and usuli one is somehow the middle one, I mean the rational one and the middle one, or not?
You know what, akhbari and usuli are two opposite sides.
Okay.
But philosophical side, we cannot say that this is the third one that, mm-hmm, doesn't accept the other two.
Yes.
No, nowadays we have a lot of scholars, they are usuli and philosopher.
Yes.
But in the field of akhbari, you know, the akhbari scholars, usually they do not accept philosophy. You know, usuli scholars don't have any problem with philosophy. Mm-hmm. Some of them accept and some. You know, because in akhbari, they, as my brother mentioned, they believe that the only source of religion is riwayat.
Yes.
Not ijtihad and not philosophy. You know, in ijtihad, you refer to Quran, to hadith, and your aql.
Yes.
And in philosophy, usually, mostly, you refer to the to aql. Of,
yes,
course, we have the school of Hikmat Muta'aliyah.
Yes.
Which is the combination of Quran, Rivayat, and aql. Mainly, the problem is about akhbari school of thought. You know, the problem is that in akhbari school of thought, they usually, they oppose,
mm-hmm,
the usage of ration,
yes,
and aql.
Yes.
And this is the first problem. The first problem is that our religion doesn't oppose the aql.
Mm-hmm.
If aql was useless, so why did God create that?
Yes.
And why are we ordered to use that a lot, even in Quran? We have a lot of order about tadabbur. Tadabbur means to use your aql. This is the first problem. If you want to close the door, the gate of aql and ration, this is yes. not what our religion
yes.
Asks us. The second problem is that even about akhbar, means riwayat and hadith, usually they don't care about the source of riwayat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, akhbari scholars used to accept everything which was called riwaya.
That's right.
And they were not careful about the source of riwaya. You know, I want to quote a sentence from Ayatollah Ma'rifat, which is one of the most important yes. scholars in Quran and Hadith. He said in the book Siyanat al-Quran min al-Tahrif, he said that the problem that akhbari scholars made for Islam is not smaller than the problem that Khawarij made for Islam.
Uh-huh.
You know why? Because if when you don't care about the source of riwaya and you gather everything called uh-huh. riwaya,
yes.
so here in the combined riwayas
yes.
that you gather,
yes.
there may have been a lot of problem, you know, which jali riwayat,
yes.
fake riwayat,
yes.
Which mainly was forged in order to destroy Islam.
Yes.
And they gather
the true
that
face of Ahl al-Bayt sometimes.
But
that's
some
right.
scholars like Sayyid Abdullah Shobat, they yes. try to clarify that this is not correct school of thought,
mm-hmm.
to gather riwayat without caring about the source. You know, when we say usuli doesn't mean that they do not accept riwayat. Our mujtahids nowadays, they use riwayat.
That's right.
But how to use? We have three sciences, Rijal, Diraya, and Fiqh al-Hadith.
Yes.
After these filters, you can use Riwaya.
Yes, that's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration. Because as we said, Sayyid Abdullah Shobar was a prolific writer. His books reached also the world of our Sunni scholar. That's why so many of the Sunni scholars and ulama admired his works, including, for example, Muhammad Hussein al-Zahabi and also Hamad al-Hanafi from the University of Al-Azhar in Egypt, you know, that they talked in admiration of the multitude of the actions and the works and the, it's better to say, writings and compilations of Sayyid Abdullah al-Shobbar. The year 1242, according to the Hijri calendar, is the year in which Sayyid Abdullah al-Shobbar passed away. His body was taken into the city of Al-Kazamiyyah and he was buried in the holy courtyard of Al-Kazamiyyah. May Allah bless the soul of this prolific writer, Sayyid Abdullah Shobba. Thank you, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani.
You're welcome.
For your nice elaboration regarding his life. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio. In response to the countries and the nations who dare to take their destiny in their own hands, to self-government, to self-determination, to simply be independent,
a simplemente ser independientes,
the imperialist forces and the imperialist countries take different measures. One of the most perverse measures are the blockades and sanctions. Particularly those exercised by the United States, also by Western Europe, and sometimes even by some international organizations, such as the United Nations. Beware. The main function of these blockades is to try to complicate the life to the inhabitants of the countries with whom they have contradictions, and want them to change their way of thought, government, and administration. Because it seems that freedom, free trade, and self-determination does not exist for them. Of course, it doesn't exist. And they immediately take measures that in some cases have resulted in very serious issues in nutrition, medicine, and the most essential elements in some countries. That is to say, who is ultimately punished is the people who receive the sanctions.
Los gobiernos que han sido sancionados,
the governments that have been constantly sanctioned have become stronger in relation to their population.
Y han cambiado el modelo de desarrollo.
And have changed the development model in such a way that as the great Chinese leader and founder of the People's Republic of China, Mao Zedong, said, the reactionaries lift the rock in their hands to such an extent that when they hold it up, it falls off on their own feet, and the sanctions become something negative for those who have imposed them.
Y se convierten las sanciones en algo negativo para quienes la han llevado adelante. Así tenemos, por ejemplo, que...
Thus, for example, among 17 sanctioned countries with the highest number of sanctioned companies, individuals, and private entities,
particulares,
some have been strengthened to such a level, as is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which has had sanctions since 1950. The Republic of Cuba, which has had sanctions since 1960, and almost total since 1962, and the Islamic Republic of Iran since
1979.
Well, we also have Venezuela, where we have Venezuela today that is satisfying almost 90% of its food consumption through internal production, something that has never been in history.
Los países sancionados.
The sanctioned countries, Nicaragua and Russia, strengthen their internal construction, their internal market,
su mercado interno, su industria,
their internal industry, in such a way that they advance scientifically and militarily, deepening their independence and sovereignty, which has been a setback for imperialism. It is true that a cost that had to be paid.
Es verdad que se ha tenido que pagar un costo.
And that affects the people, all the inhabitants of the country that is sanctioned. It is the madness of imperialism, that fanatic thing of subduing others through hunger. This is what the gringos and North Americans do. This is what the Americans do. But it goes against them. Today, in the Gaza Strip, Gazans are the most sanctioned on the planet. There, not even medicines, water, or anything else is allowed to enter. Zionism and its godfather, North American imperialism, are the ones leading it. The people are wise. They persevere on the path of independence and sovereignty.
en el camino de la independencia y la soberanía.
The sanctions have proven to be a fiasco at the end of the day. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. Hoy, para hablarles de sanciones y bloqueos.
Today, we have a guest from Italy to talk about sanctions and blockade by imperialist powers against nations, governments, and countries.
Él es Fabrizio Cassari.
Fabrizio Cassari, Italian journalist and international analyst, expert in analyzing economic sanctions and punitive measures applied by capitalist powers against nations.
Capitalista a los pueblos.
Fabrizio Cassari, welcome to Black and White.
A negro y blanco.
Thank you for your invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Fabrizio, desde ubiquémonos en nuestra época desde el punto de vista contemporáneo.
At the current historical stage, what are the goals, consequences, and manifestations of these policies and sanctions by the imperialist powers?
De sanciones y bloqueos por parte de las potencias imperialistas.
La política de bloqueo y de sanciones es parte de...
The policy of blockade and sanctions is called the fourth and fifth generation war, depending on who brings it up. The modern war, which the unipolar world starts, is to simply prevent the world from becoming multipolar. In order to prevent the loss of its hegemonic role as a group, the West is increasingly using all the tools of the fifth generation war, that is diplomacy, politics, and above all, the media and sanctions, which are the tools of this war. Sanctions today affect 17 countries with specific and selective measures and 6 countries with general measures. We must note that the type of these actions can be general or targeted at individuals. Therefore, a total of 23 countries have been targeted by unilateral, illegitimate, and illegal sanctions. We are talking about 72% of the world's population and more than 30% of the entire world's GDP. I said this to understand the size and the scope of this action. Sanctions, on the other hand, result from a clear but unfair desire to win a competition, competing with products and markets. When you ban the export of a country's products and when you have the same product, you will be the only option for purchase. Furthermore, when you prevent a country from using the international transaction withdrawal system, things get more complicated. The effect of this action is not only on your target country, but also on all countries that want to do business with it. This gets even more complicated when you block a country from accessing SWIFT transactions and also block it from using the dollar currency. When a country is sanctioned, the only option left is to buy Western goods. With these conditions, the West keeps its economy in a state of addiction and says that it is the best and biggest economy. But no, the reason is sanctions. As I told you, sanctions are not a substitute for war. Many times you are told that sanctions are a substitute for war. This is a lie. Sanctions are the art of war. This should be clarified. And in the following, you will see their dire goals.
Entonces esto habría que quedarlo claro, claro. Y vamos a ver después cuáles son sus objetivos finales, ¿no?
Así es. Las sanciones son parte de la guerra. Ahora bien, ¿cómo los pueblos?
Yes, that's right. Sanctions are part of the war. Now, according to the current situation that we are witnessing, the situation has changed. As we know, we see American countries that have stood up for their rights, and how the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has strengthened in science and the military sector, etc. And Venezuela has made an incredible progress in food production. And Iran has solved a series of issues in the food security sector and has made progress in the scientific and military fields. And also in the case of Russia, it seems that the sanctions have had the opposite effect.
La propia Rusia, ¿no es cierto? Pareciera ser que el efecto fue al revés, ¿no? Es decir, hoy día,
Is there a case today that sanctions have been able to achieve the goal of overthrowing a government and changing the direction of a country?
A un gobierno a cambiar la orientación de ese estado?
Jamás, ni uno. Ni uno.
Never, not a single one. There is no country in the world that has been overthrown due to Western sanctions. When I say Western sanctions, it is actually an implicit meaning that means U.S. sanctions. And then the rest of the West also follows these sanctions, but they're not the ones who impose the sanctions. I mean specifically the European Union. EU sanctions are ridiculous. For example, it's funny when Latin American countries like Nicaragua is sanctioned because Europe's trade relations with Nicaragua are very small. What does Nicaragua lose when sanctioned? What we see is that the ultimate goal of sanctions is to topple governments. Who are these sanctions against? Against all governments that do not submit their political sovereignty, resources, and political identity to the West, or in fact, America. Countries that believe that they have the right to choose their own government, as well as the right to choose the government's program, goals, and international stance, are considered enemies. How do they become enemies? A campaign is started which almost always says that those countries are violating human rights.
Se comienza la campaña diciendo que esos países casi siempre, siempre violan los derechos humanos.
Ahí vamos a quedar.
We will take a break for a few moments and then continue the second part with Fabrizio Casari.
Volvemos, estamos acá con Fabrizio Casari.
Back here we are with Fabrizio Casari. The discussion is about embargo and blockade. You were giving reasons for your own explanations. Go ahead, Fabrizio, please.
Adelante, por favor, Fabrizio.
Y lo que decía es que no haya habido ni un gobierno en el mundo.
Yes, I was saying that there is not a single government in the world that has been overthrown due to the sanctions of the United States and the West. And there is no government that will fall because of this in the future. This is a zero-sum game, and when despite the efforts of America and the West, when the desired result is not achieved, it means America's defeat. Sanctions are illegitimate because they have not been declared by any international court or the United Nations, which are the only organizations that have the authority to impose sanctions. These sanctions are illegal because they're not announced by the courts. They are announced by the offices of a ministry, and they are part of the political actions. These sanctions are unfair because the people being sanctioned have nothing to do with the government that may or may not fall. But the reality is that they hit the governments that do not surrender their political sovereignty and resources to America. Governments that do not want to determine their own political line and place in international confrontations in exchange for not being sanctioned. These countries are immediately considered by the U.S. as enemy countries, and then the U.S. says that these countries violate human rights or claim that these countries are declared an extraordinary threat to the security of the U.S. Why do they say this, despite the fact that it is a country 30,000 kilometers away? They say this, and they make management statements about it so that they later commit the most theft of resources based on these words. They must have a political justification for their robberies and looting, otherwise the law of America itself will not allow them to do so. The point is that 72% of the world's population is sanctioned by the other 25%. Can a system like this continue to work? Obviously not. Can almost 30% of the GDP be sanctioned? Because the one who used to have 60% of the production and now this figure doesn't even reach 40% of the world's gross domestic product makes such a decision. These are questions that all lawyers and people with knowledge in the world have. But in addition to some of this conversation, there's also the boomerang effect of sanctions. What will happen? When some countries are sanctioned, the United States and Europe cannot officially sell those products, and this causes their products to be stockpiled. These products expire. For one, because I remind you again, we are talking about 72% of the world's population. So when you know that you can't do business with 72% of the world's population, you can't sell anything to them. You can't buy anything from them. Your production will only be for 28% of the world's population. This amount is very, very low. So your economy will have very, very little growth and possibly negative growth. So this is what is officially on paper, while the U.S. has historically shown that it sanctions with one hand and negotiates with the other. One example is that they announced that they want to impose the biggest and toughest sanctions in history against Russia. Now, on the other hand, as a result of this action, the growth of Russia's GDP is higher than that of the European Union, which said it wanted to finish Russia's work. On the other hand, the oil and gas that reaches Europe, which they said can no longer come from Russia, still comes from Russia. It just happens that it goes through other countries, and because of that, they charge you more. So you have the same oil as before, just a little less volume, and you're paying a lot more money for it than before. And you're no longer dependent on one country, but three or four. And of course, the gas that you are going to get from the U.S., the U.S. liquefied natural gas, the amount is very small and not enough for Europe at all. And the price is much more expensive than what Russia was giving you. So what a smart person at the center of the unipolar imperial decision-making apparatus would adopt such a stupid strategy.
Parto decisional del imperio unipolar decide semejante estrategia idiota.
Una estrategia idiota, como dices tú, Fabricio. De cualquier manera...
A stupid strategy, as you said, Fabrizio. Fortunately, countries have been able to industrialize and ensure their own food security and develop in this direction. This is one of the consequences of sanctions. This is a very complicated matter. On the other hand, there is a very interesting phenomenon, which is the coordination, unity and cooperation between the embargoed countries, which is a kind of resistance and building a different environment.
Que también es una forma de resistencia y de construir un espacio distinto. Mira.
Look, the nations of the sanctioned countries use their intelligence to make fun of many, or in fact, all sanctions. I remember when I was in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, they definitely made fun of some of the sanctions. As I remember that in the period of socialist Albania, in the period between 1976 and 1986, there were large companies producing textile products, and all of their products ended up in the market with the label Made in Italy.
Telares, mucho. Y todos, al final salían al mercado, y estaban en el mercado, con la etiqueta Made in Italia.
This means that nations have the ability to overcome sanctions and blockades in any way. What experience do you have of dealing with and passing behind sanctions?
Para superarlos. ¿Qué experiencia tú ves aquí en el desarrollo desde los pueblos para enfrentar y superar estas sanciones?
La cuestión es incrementar.
The issue is a significant increase in development of South-South relations. South-South relations should take the place of North. Today it is much easier to exchange products with any other country than it was 20 years ago. Every country can achieve a level of production of products and services. The policy of imperialism is stupid because they don't take into account that in the past, until about 50 to 20 years ago, resources were exchanged with technology and its improvements. Today, the owners of resources no longer need new technologies. Because firstly, some countries have very, very advanced technology. And secondly, if the technology doesn't reach them, there are countries that are willing to give the technology, for example, China, Russia, and Brazil itself. So what is the threat where the logic of exchange prevails? When you pay the price of my product at the international market, and if you want, you cannot do the exchange, the idea of you sanctioning me is stupid. You see, they sanctioned the Russian oil and gas pipeline to Europe and wanted to prevent Russian gas from reaching Europe. But what happened was that gas flows from Turkey and Azerbaijan and then returns here. What did Russia do? It used to have a strong trading partner, the European Union, and specifically Germany and two lines that transported oil and gas quickly and directly. For political reasons, he sold gas at a very low price. Today, it sells this gas at a relatively higher price to India and China and to other countries such as Pakistan, countries that did not buy it before. Russia started diversifying its customers and therefore has many more customers than before and is much less dependent on one customer only.
Al diversificar la cartera, a tener mucha más gente que te compra, tener mucha menos dependencia de cualquiera de ellos.
La realidad actual donde se comienza.
Today's reality is that countries are starting to do business with their own national currencies. India works with rupees, Russia with rubles, China with yuan, etc. Today, therefore, the dollar is not very decisive. How does this approach affect the possibility of circumventing or neutralizing sanctions?
En la posibilidad de sortear o burlar las sanciones.
Mira, hermano, en una forma muy fácil, es un desastre para Estados Unidos.
Look, brother, this is very easy. It's a disaster for America, because thanks to the dollar, as the only player in international exchange, America was given the ability and power in international trade to determine who sells what and who buys what and the terms of payment, and this way it earns billions of dollars per day per transaction. This situation is not going to continue now. The dollar will no longer be the only medium of exchange. According to the predictions made in a 10-year period, the dollar will probably not be the first currency. Why? Because as always, there's a proverb that says, idiots, in addition to being stupid, also become blind. When the US tried to sanction Russia, it made it impossible for Russia to access the dollar market and the Russian account was blocked, like what they did with Venezuela in the past. Most of the countries in the international level have resources abroad. For emergencies, it can happen. Now, most all strategic reserves have been in dollars. Now, there are many countries that say, if I ever get into a conflict with America for any reason, America will stop me and take all my reserves from me. No, it is better not to do this. And they are de-dollarizing their reserves. There are many countries that willingly de-dollarize their resources gradually without creating a monetary shock. And many more countries are planning to do this. Having less dollars means having less demand for dollars. Less demand for dollars means less production of dollars. Less production of dollars means that the U.S. debt cannot be paid.
Por la deuda de los Estados Unidos, la cara de impagable.
Gracias, Fabrizio. Desgraciadamente.
Thank you, Fabrizio. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of the program. Thank you very much for your participation. This is Black and White.
Muchas gracias.
De nada. Adiós.
Adiós.
In the limelight.
Tel Aviv is coming up against myriad obstacles, from the loss of Western public opinion to the nervousness of its key backers. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's attempts to keep this war going for as long as possible are not being helped from within. Two senior members of the war cabinet have defied the Prime Minister's wishes publicly. The first act of public defiance came from War Minister Yoav Gallant, who announced that he would only agree to present a new military draft law if MK Benny Gantz's National Unity Party agreed on how to regulate the exemption of yeshiva students from conscription. Gallant effectively gave Gantz a veto on the law, on which government funding to yeshivas whose students refuse to serve depends. Without such a law, Haredi parties would leave the coalition and collapse the Zionist government. The second act came from Gantz, who made unsanctioned visits to the US and Britain, in which Netanyahu ordered his embassies not to cooperate. But such is Netanyahu's political weakness, that neither Gantz nor Gallant can be fired. A third blow to Netanyahu in as many weeks was the recent statement by Sephardi Chief Rabbi Yitzhak Yosef, who said that if the government were to enforce compulsory military service on the Haredim, they would leave Israel en masse. Yosef was denounced by a Jerusalem Post editorial that said his words were an insult to the troops risking their lives in Gaza. The Zionist regime's war leader has less and less authority within Israel to conduct war he wants. The balance of power between the child killer regime of Israel and the resistance group Hamas is also not as clear-cut as it might seem at first glance. Another sign of their confidence in their ability to shape the future of Palestine and its leadership is their list of prisoners who would be released in exchange for the remaining Israeli hostages. The latest list includes Marwan Barghouti, the Fatah leader sentenced to 5 culminative life sentences and 40 years in prison for his acts in the Second Intifada; Ahmad Sadat, Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine; Abdullah Barghouti, the Hamas military leader; and Ibrahim Hamid, the leader of the Second Intifada. If any of these men were released, the effect would be a strategic shake-up of the Palestinian leadership across all factions. For Palestinians, this would be a huge political renewal. It would also mean the definitive end of a Palestinian authority that collaborates with their occupation. For the Zionist regime, the release of these men would present a real chance to negotiate an end to the conflict. But only the likes of Ami Ayalon, the former head of Shin Bet, gets this point. Instead, the war cabinet's latest idea is to put another PA stooge, Majed Farage, in charge of Gaza. Farage's mission is doomed before it starts, and it would be wise to decline such a poisoned chalice. Netanyahu's weakness is having a profound effect on the Western political elites who supported and armed the Zionist regime. U.S. President Joe Biden's rift with Netanyahu is now open and in the public eye. The U.S. leader, who said so loudly that Israel had every right to defend itself 5 months ago, now says Israel cannot kill another 30,000 Palestinians in the name of self-defense. We don't believe Biden has had some dramatic change of heart or that the scales have fallen from his eyes. U.S. government officials are fully informed about what is happening on the ground in Gaza at every stage of his operation. They knew, for instance, that resistance groups were not diverting aid convoys or stealing food, and said so. If Biden is confronting the consequences of having given the Zionist regime the brightest of green lights to invade Gaza after the October 7th events, those consequences are primarily electoral. Biden's team has been shocked by the extent of uncommitted vote. Hundreds of thousands of voters across the U.S. voted for no candidate in the Democratic primaries on Super Tuesday, as the movement urging voters to vote uncommitted gathers pace in protest against Biden's handling of the war in Gaza. This could cost him in the general election in November. Biden's Ramadan greetings were especially warm this year, but Arab Americans don't want hugs. They want a change of policy, and Biden still only supports a temporary ceasefire, not a permanent one. He has not threatened to stop the supply of weapons to Israel. Nevertheless, there has been a deliberate shift in tone. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the U.S., was full-throated in his support for the Zionist regime after the October 7th events. Recently, he warned the Zionist regime it cannot survive if it becomes a global pariah. Schumer accused Netanyahu of putting political survival above national interest and said he had been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for the Zionist regime worldwide to historic lows. Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah, he said. The loss of public opinion in the West, the continuing genocide case at the International Court of Justice, the erosion of Jewish consensus, and the nervousness of the Zionist regime's backers, all of these elements point to a strategic defeat for the child killer regime of Israel. Even if the war stops now, the price the Israeli regime has paid for the reoccupation of Gaza will be higher than it could have possibly calculated 5 months ago, but it has yet to realize this. It will.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being excited about the holy month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, dear friends, we are in the holy month of Ramadan. What a beautiful month to be witnessing in our lives, and what a great blessing from the Almighty Allah that we have been given the opportunity to be able to witness a holy month of Ramadan, this most holiest of months, in which, of course, we know that its days are the best of days, and its nights are the best of nights, its hours the best of hours. A month which is so holy that even our sleeping is considered to be the worship of the Almighty Allah. What a beautiful month indeed. And so one of the things, though, that we have a tendency to, you know, not really feel is to feel happy and excited about the holy month of Ramadan. Now, for those of us who are older, you know, and we have witnessed a few holy months of Ramadan already, you know, we don't have that excitement that perhaps we used to have. Or perhaps, you know, God forbid, we never had an excitement towards the holy month of Ramadan. Now, the holy month of Ramadan and this fasting and this feast of Allah, this is something which, you know, on a yearly basis, it teaches us to connect back with our Islamic lifestyle. So throughout the year, for example, you know, we kind of stray away from that pure and blessed and that epitome of an Islamic lifestyle that we are trying to achieve. You know, we kind of stray from that peak that we are trying to reach. And so the holy month of Ramadan helps us to come back and connect with that beautiful Islamic lifestyle that we are trying to achieve. And perhaps this is, you know, one of the things that we don't understand and we don't realize and we don't comprehend. And because we don't comprehend it, then we aren't happy about the holy month of Ramadan.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about being happy and being excited about the holy month of Ramadan. You know, so we had said in the previous segment that sometimes people that are a little bit older and they have witnessed a few holy months of Ramadan, they don't have that same excitement or that same, I guess, you know, happiness and cheerfulness about the holy month of Ramadan. And we said how there's unfortunately some of us out there, you know, who have never felt any excitement for the holy month of Ramadan, whether we've seen many or a few. Now, something for parents out there, this is applicable. We need to try to find ways to make the holy month of Ramadan exciting for our children. So they should really be looking forward to the holy month of Ramadan, and they should, you know, really be excited about the holy month of Ramadan. And it's something that we'll talk about in another program, inshallah. So one of the reasons why we are not happy or not excited about the holy month of Ramadan, whether it is in the beginning, you know, or towards the middle, because sometimes in the beginning we're really excited and cheerful, but halfway through the holy month, we, you know, our energy level starts to go down and we're not happy about the holy month of Ramadan anymore, is because we don't understand the essence of the holy month of Ramadan. We don't understand what is going on in this holy month of Ramadan. We don't understand the true meaning of the holy month of Ramadan and all the different aspects of it that are to our benefit. And I mean, you're going to have to listen to some of our A to Z programs in order to realize the benefits of the holy month of Ramadan. But if we know the essence and we know what's going on and we understand the value and importance and the benefits of the holy month of Ramadan, then we're going to be extra excited and extra happy about this holy month. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, 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 ya Habib. Ramadan.
IRIB English Radio.